Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Klass as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Let's clear out winter and clean up the lawn with Spring Black Friday Savings at the Home Depot. Right now, get the Ryobi One Plus Leaf Blower for just $89 and make your lawn work easier with a powerful 90 miles an hour of clearing power. And with convenient online shopping, you can order on the app, pick up in store, and get outside sooner. Get your yard spring ready with the Ryobi One Plus Leaf Blower, now just $89 during Spring Black Friday at the Home Depot. How doers get more done.
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind, a production of iHeartRadio.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Joe McCormick. And today I wanted to start off with a short reading of a few lines from the Odyssey that will introduce the subject we're getting into for the next few episodes. So this is from the Odyssey, Book 11. I'm going to be reading from the Emily Wilson translation. But this is a section of the story where Odysseus is describing the horrors that he witnessed in Hades. And there are different kinds of horrors. Like, some of the horror of Hades is just a kind of profound, depressing disappointment with when he's confronted with the reality of how crappy it is to be dead. You know, that like he tries to talk to Ajax and Ajax can't even really say anything. But then there's this other section where he starts seeing more Dantean inferno kind of horrors of actual tortures. And so he sees King Minos, he sees Orion, he sees Sisyphus, famously, you know, in the futile labor of pushing the boulder up a hill, only to see it roll down again. But eventually he comes to a figure called Tantalus. And then here's what Odysseus says about Tantalus. "I saw the pain of Tantalus, in water to his chin, so parched, no way to drink. When that old man bent down toward the water, it was gone. Some god had dried it up, and at his feet dark earth appeared. Tall leafy trees hung fruit above his head, sweet figs and pomegranates and brightly shining apples and ripe olives, but when he grasped them with his hands, the wind hurled them away towards the shadowy clouds." Now, when I look at the contraposition of the two tortures of Tantalus, you got the one, you know, he always wants to reach up to get the delicious fruit from the tree, but the wind kicks up, it pulls it out from his hands, and he can't ever get the food. That's a torture in Tartarus by starvation, which is not good. Obviously, starvation is very bad, and it's probably more expressively phrased, the second half of this situation. But it's actually the first half that fills me with more horror when it talks about how he's standing in water. So it's like, you know, he feels it lapping around on his skin. But every time he tries to kneel down to put his face to it to get a drink, the water just is pulled away as if by a tide. The gods dry it up away from his mouth and he can't ever have a drink. To me, that's the more terrifying half of this situation.
I love the image of Tantalus as this this being that is he's like he's suspended between his desires, between his needs or desires, depending on how you want to frame it here.
Right. Well, I guess this raises questions about the biology of your shade in Hades or Tartarus. Like, does it actually need to eat and drink and he can't get it? Or is this just some kind of, psychological need his soul has that's not really biological?
I guess, yeah, given what we believe about the underworld via other myth cycles, I guess it's the idea that he doesn't actually need the fruit or the water to live. If you call this living, he's forever suspended in the state of undeath and unlife, but wants to have the water, wants to have the fruit.
Maybe that's the kind of question you're not actually supposed to bother thinking about. That's like the annoying, pedantic question that Plato would bring up.
Yeah, I mean, well, speaking of philosophy, there is the concept of Buridan's ass, named for 14th century French philosopher Jean Buridan. This is a basic idea that also pops up in the works of Aristotle and Al-Ghazali, various other writers. The more common thirst-related version is if you have a donkey that is both hungry and thirsty and placed equal distance from both food and water, it will remain immobile and die.
Now, this may be apart from the lesson that the thought experiment is trying to produce, but I think that's not necessarily true. I think there might very well be biological priorities that would place access to water above access to food.
Yeah, it's one of these paradoxes that maybe doesn't you can't exactly recreate it in reality and expect it to be quite as captivating, but abstractly, it's kind of fascinating. So as Aristotle put it, quote, "A man being just as hungry as thirsty and placed in between food and drink must necessarily remain where he is and starve to death." So obviously that's not going to be the case if you're hungry and thirsty and the waiter brings you your sandwich and your cola at the same time. You're not going to die. You don't have to give the waiter special instructions. You worked in restaurant industry, Joe. This is not like they don't tell you this, right? They don't say, look, don't put the drink and the food in front of the customer at the same time, or they will just remain immobile and die.
It is actually broadly considered very important in restaurants to get people their drinks before you get them their food. If you bring them food before they get their drinks, people will get very confused and upset.
Well, and I know I often hear, when you're a lot of times when you're hungry, you're actually thirsty, and therefore to avoid and prevent overeating, you want to make sure you have plenty of liquids as well. So yeah, like if I'm going into a restaurant situation, I definitely want my water first, because I feel like I'm gonna have a more balanced experience eating lunch or dinner there.
You'll certainly have a more pleasant experience, though. Actually, I'm just introducing exceptions to every single thing we say so far. But this does come up in a paper that I want to look at later. There is a concept that's been documented widely in animal biology known as dehydration-induced anorexia, which is essentially the idea that many animal species, certainly humans and rodents, will naturally restrict their own food intake in response to dehydration. Now, again, there are some exceptions. Some animals like get their water entirely from food and so forth. But typically, like if you get rodents and they are thirsty, they will eat less at each meal you give them. Mm. Not saying that's a way to live your life, though. I mean, better to be hydrated.
Well, coming back to mythology a bit, I thought we might mention just a few other, bits of myth and folklore and legend and so forth concerning thirst, because I feel like, we have the sort of mythological echoes of the basic biological reality, and maybe these can help and inform and shape our conversation as we move forward. So there's one particular story I was taken with from ancient China. It's an ancient story dating back at least as far as the Shanghai Jing. This is the fabulous Book of Monsters that we did a couple episodes on, I think, last year, and have recently or will be rerunning those episodes very soon.
The title is sometimes translated as The Classic of the Mountains and Seas.
Yeah. So there's a lot of mythological beings and places mentioned in the book, there is this account of Kuo Fu, It's a story that continues to be told today in modern China, and there have been many versions of it, according to Yang and Turner in Chinese mythology. Basically, what you have in Kuafu is this primordial giant with two yellow snakes circling his ears and two more yellow snakes in his hands. And he's powerful, very powerful, certainly, but he overestimates his own power. And depending on the story and the exact telling, he either challenges the sun to a race, or he just wants to chase the sun's shadow and catch the sun. I've also read a version where he wants to prolong the day by catching the sun. Like, if I can just get my hands on the sun, then it can't move away, it can't set, the day will never end.
Oh, that's a good plan.
Yeah, well, either way it works out, this giant runs after the sun, intending to catch it. But the sun stays just ever out of his grasp. And what happens? Well, he grows ever thirstier. So eventually he just has to stop for a second and he drinks the Yellow River. Then he stops and he drinks another river. But he's still so thirsty that he heads for the Great Marsh to the north. But on the way there, he collapses. He dies of thirst. And this is one of those stories that is often used to explain geography. So there are all these different details about what happens to his body once he falls, what happens to his walking stick or his club once it falls, what happens to the dirt from his sandals. You know, they become foothills, that kind of thing.
Oh, I see.
It's also a tale about just overreaching. And so the idea of this giant chasing the sun is the idea that, yeah, he's powerful, but he thinks he's more powerful than he is, and it's going to get him into trouble.
Oh, that's interesting, because to bring it back to Tantalus, I mean, it's somewhat different, but both stories have the problem with the character is that they are in some way brazen or over audacious in their challenging of celestial figures or gods, because there are multiple stories of what Tantalus did in order to deserve this punishment in Tartarus. But one of the most commonly received stories is that it's often said that Tantalus shared a table with the gods. So he was a king, but he'd be invited up to Olympus to dine with Zeus. And apparently at some point Tantalus was serving a banquet to the gods. And as the main course, for some reason, he decided to kill and serve his own son. So he that's a bad choice. So he boils his own son, serves his meat to the gods. It's like this horrible sommelier competition. Like, can you tell this is my son you're eating? And the gods can tell. They are good sommeliers, so they figure it out. And apparently cannibalism and the killing of kin were considered among the worst taboos in ancient Greece. So it's like a story of the guy doing like the worst, most awful thing you can imagine in order to embarrass or humiliate the gods. And the gods catch him doing it, so they send him to this horrible punishment in the afterlife. And so I do think it's kind of telling that this is a guy who does like the worst thing you could possibly imagine doing in ancient Greek ideas, like that he commits the worst violent taboos, killing his own son and trying to get the gods to commit cannibalism. And what is the punishment for that? It's eternal, unsatiable hunger and thirst.
Yeah, yeah. There's something about thirst, especially, that it's just so it's so primal, and it's this thing that can just crescendo towards madness and, of course, death. So we find numerous accounts where the gods become involved with human thirst. There's an interesting story in Hindu traditions. This one appears in the Mahabharata. It's about a desert-dwelling sage by the name of Uttanka. There are various accounts of what he got up to, but there's basically one of the key ideas here is that he was witness to Krishna's universal form. So this is the same universal form that's shown to Arjuna during the famous "Now I am become death" encounter.
Oh yeah, okay.
But with Uttanka, he's given a special divine boon. So he's told whenever he feels thirst, his thirst will be quenched. So there's this idea that he's followed by rain clouds, even in the desert. And so sometimes you'll see these clouds in real life referred to as Uttanka's clouds. Clouds sent by the gods to follow him around.
Hmm.
And there's another story too that involves him thirsting and the thirst being quenched, but water being sent to him via a member of a lesser caste, a lower caste, and then he refuses. And as it turns out, the water in question was going to be the potion of immortality, but he was not ready to receive it spiritually because he was not willing to accept it from this individual.
Hmm. Coming back to the earlier detail in this where Utanka is given the boon that whenever he is thirsty, his thirst will be quenched, I wonder, what is the more specific imagination of that scenario? Like, that water will appear somehow for him to drink, or that there's a kind of quenching without water, in which case it kind of makes you think, what is quenching? Because when I think of the feeling of quenching thirst, it is specifically the feeling of like water filling your mouth and going down your throat.
Hmm. Yeah. It's not just the idea that we're going to suddenly feel magically. Of course, how would that happen, right? You can't just turn it off with a switch. Our primary means of alleviating thirst is to drink water, and therefore, it's hard to disconnect the two.
Well, actually, one of the some of the studies I want to talk about as we go on in this series have to do with what is the relationship between the feeling of thirst quenching and the hydration of the body. It's not as direct as you might think.
Hmm. Now, another example of supernatural thirst, and in this case also hunger. Of course, you have in various Eastern traditions, you have hungry ghosts. And the gaki are a type of hungry ghost in the tradition of Japan, also described as always hungry and always thirsty, just monsters of torment. So they have huge bellies, bestial heads, talons, and so forth. And their home is the barren wasteland realm of Gakido. And they sometimes drag the dying to hell, but they can be driven out through ceremonies. I think that they also are often illustrated as having very narrow necks. So it's like their hunger is great. Their belly is great. Their neck is narrow. Like their throat is narrow. Their ability to quench their bodily hunger and thirst is entirely insufficient. Of course, hungry ghosts are widespread, again, in Eastern traditions. But I ran across an interesting tradition from pre-Islamic Arab culture that I'd never heard of before that I thought was really interesting, and it concerns owls. I was reading Echoes of a Thirsty Owl by T. Emil Homeran, published in the Journal of Near Eastern Studies from 1985. So the author here writes that there was an idea, in pre-Islamic Arab cultures, that the soul of a bird was, quote-unquote, spread out through the body of a human being. And when the human died, the resulting bird circled the body and cried out over the grave of the deceased. So then in time, this bird grows, and it becomes a savage and shrieking owl. And the owl, of course, haunts the places of death.
Well, that almost makes me wonder. I mean, I think about the spooky movie trope of having an owl hooting in the darkness in the graveyard, but I don't know. The more I think about that, that's probably a coincidence.
Well, I mean, owls are associated with death and the supernatural throughout various cultures, you know, because they're creatures of the night. They fly so silently that it's almost like they're not even there. Mm-hmm. They have those large eyes. Their head appears to have various kind of humanoid qualities. Mm-hmm. I think there is some connection there. Maybe not a direct connection, but a connection via the widespread associations in various cultures between the owl and the dead.
Okay.
And also with various omens, you know, sometimes in different cultures, the owl is a dire omen to behold.
Well, I guess this would depend on the owl species, but also their vocalizations have to play a role in spooky associations.
Yeah, yeah. And I think, sometimes owls don't make a sound at all. Again, either they're flying silently or they're just sitting there silently, just kind of watching. And so maybe connected to that it's also said that these owls may also just sort of check in on sons and grandsons to see what happens after they have died. Other traditions say that the owl will return to the grave once every century. And then there's this idea that in the event that the deceased might seek vengeance for something or another, the grave of the dead should be watered to, quote, slake the thirst of the dead.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Now, of course, in this, we're probably getting into that you know, something we hinted at already, the idea that, that thirst takes on so many different forms, and the water that quenches the thirst or the liquid that quenches the thirst takes on so many different forms in our traditions. Like, is thirst, thirst is of course something we all feel. It's, you know, we all need water, but depending on how it's written up, you could, you can describe thirst as a need or as a desire, as something that your will has, the ability to overcome or not overcome. You know, thirst can be, portrayed as something positive, like the thirst for knowledge, the thirst for God, but also thirst can be seen as like the thirst for wine or for blood or for vengeance.
Well, yeah, exactly. So I was also thinking about the abstract metaphors of thirst that we use, and what it means to choose that word in particular, to say that you want something by saying that you thirst for it. So in the example of someone who has a thirst for vengeance, how is that different from just wanting vengeance? To me, at least in that case, thirst as a metaphor for want implies a kind of irrational desperation in the acquisition behavior, something that will be sought without hindrance and without reason. Now, obviously, that wouldn't exactly apply to other metaphorical uses of thirst, like you said, the thirst for knowledge. But again, that word choice seems to me to imply something different than somebody just saying somebody likes knowledge or seeks knowledge. Mm-hmm. It suggests a kind of primal need, I guess.
Yeah. And I guess you also have to factor in that, you know, for a lot of us, we live in very water-rich environments and water-rich cultures and socioeconomic places. So, you know, we don't feel true thirst for the most part. You know, we don't feel the thirst that is approaching madness and death. And then again, it comes down to like, what is the person thirsting for? If you're talking about somebody feeling a mighty thirst, but you're alluding to their desire to have an alcoholic beverage, like that's a slightly different thing than just talking about, oh, well, this is thirsty work that they're doing, and, you know, implying that they're just building up a natural need for a big draught of water to satisfy their thirst.
Yeah, it seems when people use thirst to talk about alcohol, I always detect an air of irony in that usage.
Yeah.
Like, it's supposed to be a little bit funny that you're using it that way.
Right. Because if you're truly thirsty, the alcohol is not what you should be using to quench your thirst. Now, just to come back to the idea of these owls briefly, apparently some writings say that the blood and the brain in the deceased fused together after death to form the owl. Others would say that it was born of one's bones and that the owl would then erupt from the head, which I think is a wonderful and horrifying supernatural picture. Mm-hmm. But it was referenced in a number of different poems by a lot of pre-Islamic Arab poets. The Arabic poet Alan Bari wrote, quote, "And it is said that man, when he is killed and his revenge is not taken, an owl comes out of his grave and then continues screeching, 'Quench me, quench me,' continuing so until his killer is killed."
Whoa.
Anyway, that article is titled "Echoes of a Thirsty Owl." If anyone's interested, I recommend reading that. He also compares it to various other traditions concerning the owl as some sort of a supernatural being. He talks a little bit about the role of the owl in Greek mythology and so forth.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential, and then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own? Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back.
Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
There's two kinds of people in the world, people who love Health Aid kombucha and people who have never tried it. The bubbly mix of probiotic tea and refreshing juice is delicious and good for your gut health, with great flavors to choose from that you can't help but love. If you've never tried it before, maybe try a bottle or can of passion fruit tangerine or ginger lemon. Your taste buds and your gut will thank you. Look for the brown bottle with an anchor on it and try Health Aid kombucha today.
Health Aid kombucha.
Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. If you haven't heard of Visible, now you have. They're the wireless carrier that's making wireless visible. It's in the name. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. Having a one-line plan means you only need you to save. No estranged roommates, exes, cousins twice removed, or AI-powered humanoid robots needed. And because $25 a month really means $25 a month, you can call, text, stream, whatever, as much as you want without worrying about getting dinged at the end of the month.
No hidden fees, no surprises. No, really. It's like the old saying goes, you can't judge a book by its cover, but you can judge a company by its name. So spread the word. Tell all your friends there's a wireless company out there with transparency in their name, and they're called Visible. Start saving on wireless today at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can waste another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can conquer it. I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. Any road. The steeper, the better. Because my all-new Santa Fe is available with H-Track all-wheel drive, so I can hit the trail without a worry in the world. Heck, with three rows and best-in-class rear cargo space, I can pack the whole family in with all our gear. We've got available dual wireless charging for our phones, so we'll never lose touch with civilization, and we won't lose touch with the primordial power of Mother Earth. So which is it? Waste the weekend? Or do something a little more epic and conquer it in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Now, we can't very well cover a complete cultural history of human thirst here, but it is worth driving home that thirst is an important aspect of history and civilization. In obvious ways, and maybe sometimes in less obvious ways, I was reading a 1994 article in the Journal of European Archaeology by Slavomil Vinkel titled The Archaeology of Thirst. And in it, the author points out that naturally, the human satisfaction of thirst is an essential part of the human experience. And it's of course of great interest in archaeology, but a number of obstacles have to be overcome. So first of all, you just have the volatile nature of liquids. You also have the scant chemical signatures to be found inside ancient drinking vessels, also scarce paleo botanical analysis of those residues. They also mention, quote, the functionally unspecific nature of most vessels, which I thought was interesting, reminded me of our holiday discussion of leg-shaped vessels.
Yeah, it's a lot of times people are like, I don't know what people would put in this leg.
Yeah, like we can assume they would put oil in it, you know, but depending on what the vessel is and what the culture is and how much additional information we have, we might just have to guess and be like, okay, it seems like you might drink out of this, or you might just, or maybe this is just for storing some sort of oil. On top of that, we often have scant iconographical information. Also, this is a big one, and this applies to far more than just drinking vessels. But if the vessel is organic in nature, we may not have any surviving examples of what it was. Mm-hmm. And on top of that, by and large, we tend to focus on exceptional examples of drinking and storage vessels, which, of course, limit study to a very slim part of a given culture. You know, so it's like a highly ornate, decorative piece that, you know, maybe is of the same shape and basic function as what people would have in general been using to drink water or store water, et cetera. But maybe not. Like maybe it is, it's more about looking interesting as opposed to anything else. But the archaeology of thirst ends up encompassing some very ancient examples, including things like Neolithic wells. Water is the most basic means of meeting human thirst, and it's taken on mundane and fantastic connotations at times. But on top of this, of course, humans have come to drink saps, blood, of course, various concoctions such as mead and wine and beer and more. But I guess water, you know, water remains the big one, obviously. And another idea worth mentioning in all of this that I was reading about is the idea that, okay, so human thirst is, of course, ubiquitous. Everybody is going to thirst. Everyone needs water. And so if you look back to Jewish and Islamic traditions, you find in both legal traditions this idea of the right of thirst, the idea being that, like, every human governed by this law has this right of thirst, to this right to water via their own thirst. And in Islamic law, apparently this extended to animals as well. Animals had the right of thirst, which gave them, meant that they had a right to access water based on their thirst. But it's also, it's interesting how, you know, this sort of, this foreshadows a lot of our modern relationship with water, the idea that the right to water is classified as a basic human right by the United Nations. Mm-hmm. But of course, at the same time, not everyone has equal access to water. And this is going to continue to be a problem moving forward. And of course, you can't help but then take all of that and relate it back to our metaphorical treatment of thirst. You know, how does that change? You know, if you're talking about thirst in reference to you know, spiritual needs and you know, a thirst for knowledge, like, how is that different if you're expressing that within a, you know, in a place where water is plentiful, where drinking water is plentiful, or a place where access is more limited? But I guess before we can answer any of these questions, we need to back up quite a bit and just talk about thirst as a biological reality. What is it and how does it work?
Yeah. And so this was actually rather interesting to me because it turns out I knew less about thirst than I realized. And what we do know about thirst and what we don't know about thirst are both pretty interesting. So I was reading an article called Thirst that was published in Current Biology in 2016 by David E. Lieb, Christopher A. Zimmerman, and Zachary A. Knight. And this article is essentially a summary of all the existing research on thirst. It was, as of the year 2016, a sort of perfect primer catching everybody up on what do we know about thirst and what do we not know. Now, before we get into the meat of that discussion, I guess to just cover the very basics, the first fact before we get into anything else, you are a water bag. That is what we are. That is what all of us are. We are not just simple water bags, but our bodies are essentially water bags over any other material description. All the animal life that currently lives on land evolved from creatures that used to live in the ocean, where you're surrounded by water all the time. And when we evolved to live on land, we had to create essentially bags that would contain water to take with us. Because all of the biological chemistry, the biochemistry of life, takes place in water, in solutions of water. And so as water bags, we are complex autonomous water bags, but most of those complex autonomous activities actually require that there be a fairly precise amount of water in the bag and a fairly precise concentration of various substances, things like sodium, for instance, that pretty precise amounts be dissolved in the water in the bag. And so various processes of life are constantly leading to water coming in and out of the bag. So there are several common routes of water to be added to the bag. We're familiar with the most common of those, which is drinking fluid, drinking water or fluids that are mainly water, or eating food with water content. And that the second one there, eating food with water content, is less prominent for humans because, you know, we typically drink a glass of water with food or between meals or whatever. But mm-hmm. there are some animals that basically get almost all of their water from their food.
Yeah, this includes certain desert species such as the kangaroo rat and the the kangaroo mouse, which of course on the planet Arrakis becomes the mouse Muad'Dib. We also have things like the sand cat, the sand gazelle. I know just in my household, it also seems to include my cat, who does not seem to drink water at all anymore. We have to lean heavily on moist foods to get her liquids. So feeding her wet food, adding a little bit of water, like sneaking it into the wet food. And yet if we make the wet food too wet, she will say, no, it's too much like water. I will not have it.
Wow.
And then we put out water for her. We've tried the fountains. We've tried everything. The only thing she ever actually drank out of was a fish tank when we had a fish tank. And then she would not stop drinking out of the fish tank. But any other thing we've tried, she hasn't gone for. And so when she's had some issues before, it's like, you know, she's clearly dehydrated. In the past, we've even had to use an IV to give her the water. So we still have a whole bunch of bags of fluid around in case she has any flare-ups of her issues. But in terms of just like drinking straight water, she's not interested at all.
Wow. Well, simultaneously, that is kind of fascinating. But also, I feel for her and I feel for you guys. That sounds very frustrating.
Everybody seems to be at a comfortable level right now. She seems to be getting all the liquid she needs through her her meat paste. But it's weird with cats because, yeah, I think some people have this experience with cats where they really have to be tricked into drinking water. But others will just drink it on the fly out of toilets or dripping faucets and so forth.
Right. So all of that is direct water acquisition. So, of course, you get water from drinking water. You get some smaller amount of water from eating food that contains water. But then apparently there's a secondary route for water acquisition by eating food through what's known as metabolic water, which is when your metabolism oxidizes various energy-containing substances that you eat and produces water in the process. So some water is created at the molecular level by your metabolism. And there are some organisms that get a large amount of their water content from metabolic water. Humans only get a very small amount from it. But yeah, I mean, I think like some desert dwelling organisms and some birds and stuff get all or almost all of their water by chemical reactions that happen inside their body after they eat food and turn parts of that food into water molecules.
Now, one of the interesting things I was reading about some of these desert species, at least with some of them, you know, if they're in captivity and they are offered water, well, then when their thirst builds up, they will drink the water. So it's not like everything. I don't want to imply that anything out there that gets most of its water through its meat is going to be like my cat and just refuse to drink water. You know, she has her own issues going on.
Yeah, I'm sure that varies by organism. Okay, but those are the routes in. You've got directly through drinking and eating, and then secondarily through metabolism. But then you've got a number of routes for water to be eliminated. So you've got urination, of course, and then you've got loss through defecation. You've got evaporation through the lungs. So people sometimes don't think about this, but you lose water when you exhale. Water vapor comes out of your mouth or out of your nose. And then there is also evaporative loss of water through the skin, such as through sweating. So, and then other more minor things. I mean, obviously some extremely tiny amount of water evaporates off of the liquid on the surface of your eyes and so forth. But those are the big ones.
The defecation is worth mentioning, probably stressing again, because I think most people are probably familiar with this. But obviously, if one is is suffering from a condition that results in diarrhea or is some sort of dysentery situation, you end up losing more and more water through defecation, and therefore you have to make sure you're drinking more and more water to make up for that water loss.
Right.
Also, just a reminder, anyone out there, a well-fitted and well-manufactured still suit will collect all of this as it leaves your body. All the routes out will be covered, and you'll lose no more than a thimble's worth of water per day.
We got to stress well-fitted, though. You get the still suit on there, you're going to have all kinds of gaps and things not working right.
That's right. You don't know how to work the straps, and you don't have that forehead piece on correctly. It's just not going to work at an optimal level.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride.
Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles in a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
There's a lot of pros to drinking Health Aid kombucha. No cons that I can think of. Pro, amazing taste. Pro, pairs well with anything. Pro, probiotic. That's a literal pro. And it's deliciously refreshing. It's the perfect pairing to your meal or great on its own, whether you're having Pink Lady Apple, Berry Lemonade, or one of the other great flavors. It's the perfect swap for soda or alcohol. Make it part of your daily routine. Look for the brown bottle with an anchor on it and try Health Aid Kombucha today.
Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. If you haven't heard of Visible, now you have. They're the wireless carrier that's making wireless visible. It's in the name. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. Having a one-line plan means you only need you to save. No estranged roommates, exes, cousins twice removed, or AI-powered humanoid robots needed. And because $25 a month really means $25 a month, you can call, text, stream, whatever, as much as you want without worrying about getting dinged at the end of the month.
No hidden fees, no surprises. No, really. It's like the old saying goes, you can't judge a book by its cover, but you can judge a company by its name. So spread the word. Tell all your friends there's a wireless company out there with transparency in their name, and they're called Visible. Start saving on wireless today at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can waste another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can conquer it. I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. Any road. The steeper, the better. Because my all-new Santa Fe is available with H-Track all-wheel drive, so I can hit the trail without a worry in the world. Heck, with three rows and best-in-class rear cargo space, I can pack the whole family in with all our gear. We've got available dual wireless charging for our phones, so we'll never lose touch with civilization, and we won't lose touch with the primordial power of Mother Earth. So which is it? Waste the weekend or do something a little more epic? And conquer it in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
All right. Well, anyway, I want to come back to some of the findings that are summarized in that current biology paper by Lieb et al. That I mentioned earlier. And again, this is from 2016. So there will be more research that we get into from after 2016 that adds to some of these findings. But this is where we were when this good summary came out. So in the human body, the brain monitors the body's water content. And when certain thresholds are reached in that information monitoring system, it motivates the body to drink fluids. Of course, it's not only the decrease of fluid volume in the body that makes us thirsty. One of the most important things to understand in the maintenance of the body's water content is the importance of something known as osmolality. That's O-S-M-O-L-A-L-I-T-Y. This is the concentration of various particles, such as electrolytes, like sodium, that are dissolved in the body's water content. And you'll see this often described as blood osmolality. It's basically functionally the same thing. The liquid part of our blood, plasma, is roughly 90% water. So when people talk about blood osmolality, they're talking about osmolality of the body's water content. The brain is actually incredibly sensitive to changes in blood osmolality. An increase in just 1% of the blood osmolality can cause an animal to feel thirst. And the authors write, quote, "This sensation in turn is sufficient to orient and energize all of an animal's actions toward the goal of finding and consuming water. Thus, the study of thirst is the study of how the brain performs this remarkable transformation, such that small changes in the composition of the blood become a potent and specific motivational drive." And the more I thought about that, the more interesting it became that essentially just sort of eating a small amount of salt, for example, is enough to motivate my brain to change all of my behavior. Because my osmolality goes up, the salt dissolved in my body's water content increases. In order to balance that out, my body wants me to go get some more water to drink, and that I will interrupt whatever I'm doing to go do it.
And we tend not to even really think about this. We don't think, oh, now my body has need of water, I must go get it. It's just like, it's just what you do.
Yeah.
Right here as we're recording, I have a big thermos of water, and I just end up casually sipping on it the whole time.
Yeah, same here. I always get a nice big glass of water before we start recording. But the question would be, why are our bodies so sensitive to these tiny changes in osmolality, in the amount of osmolites dissolved in the blood? Why would like a 1% increase in salt concentration really cause that much of a problem? Well, the authors offer some explanations. They say, first of all, you've got this thing in your body known as the electrochemical gradient. The cells in our bodies are selectively permeable to specific ions, quote, resulting in an electrochemical gradient across the plasma membrane that is exploited for numerous cellular functions. So this means that there's a difference in the electrical charge and the concentration of various chemicals on opposite sides of the membrane that surrounds each of our cells. And the difference, or the gradient here, the fact that it's different on each side of the membrane, is what permits the transportation of ions across the membrane so that cells can do things, so that they can send and receive things. So if you change your blood osmolality, you say increase the concentration of salt in the body's water content, you change this gradient. And you change the water contents inside cells and you, quote, degrade normal cellular function. Now, I was trying to think of a rough analogy, and here's what I came up with. This may be very rough, but it's my best attempt. So when you change your blood osmolality away from its ideal, I would say your body sort of becomes like a city that starts having system-wide problems opening and closing doors. Now, is the problems opening and closing doors of all kinds throughout a city get worse, eventually this would just cause myriad diverse problems throughout the city, much like it would in your body.
Well, that just sounds like chaos. That just sounds like all order is falling out the window.
Right, and you can actually see a visual representation of that chaos in a chart that the authors include in their paper, where it shows what the typical symptoms are as the blood osmolality goes too far above or below what it's supposed to be. Basically on both sides, it's sort of a mirror image with a few differences. So you got the normal range, but then you start getting away from it. You get things like irritability, lethargy, nausea, ataxia, trembling, hypothermia. And then in both cases, you end up in the seizures and death territory.
So, yeah. So basically, we have this thin little realm of stability, and to either extreme, it's just madness and death.
Right. So the body has to very carefully keep that concentration of osmolites in the right range. And if it gets off, it will take drastic measures to get it right again. But then the authors identify another major reason that the body has to keep fluid volume and osmolality at the right levels, which is blood pressure. They say your body uses blood to transport oxygen and other essential nutrients to all of its tissues. Everything in the body needs to get oxygen from the lungs and the heart, and the blood has to get there to do its work. If the volume of water in the body drops below ideal levels, blood volume actually decreases. There's not enough blood, which means the circulatory system has to work harder and harder to keep blood pressure up where it needs to be to get to all the parts of the body and deliver those nutrients. So in addition to maintaining the right concentration of those dissolved things like sodium, you also just need to have enough water in your body to keep your blood pressure up, to allow your heart to keep getting blood to all the parts of the body.
It kind of comes back to what you said earlier about, you know, we're these water bags. We're creatures made out of water. And if we don't have enough water, we don't have enough of us.
Right. Yeah. Nothing works without it.
Yeah.
Anyway, the authors say that the bodies of animals have evolved to carefully preserve blood volume and blood osmolality. And then they describe some of the main components of this system that we know about. So first of all, there are neurons that monitor blood osmolality and volume. You've got specially dedicated cells in the central nervous system that pay attention to this stuff. And when they detect a problem, they, quote, trigger a coordinated set of autonomic neuroendocrine and behavioral responses that defend these parameters against change. So one of the main measures the body can take to defend against changes in osmolality is modulating kidney function. So as osmolality increases, you get a surge of antidiuretic hormone, which makes the kidneys change tack to keep more water inside the body and make the urine more highly concentrated, make it less diluted with water. Of course, the kidneys can't do their job alone because they also have to do other things in addition to that. They have to help purge the body of toxic substances and other kinds of waste. And of course, some water volume will necessarily be lost in that process. Also, the body loses water through these other means we mentioned a minute ago, sweating, breathing, and so forth. So eventually the body will be forced to consume new water to restore the balance and the volume of the blood plasma. So that's the chemistry and the physiology, but eventually you have to get to behavior. At some point, the brain has to trigger behaviors to get new water in. So an animal thinks, I need to drink water. Of course, this behavior can be costly. There are factors working against an animal's motivation to do it because it might involve spending energy finding and traveling to a water source. It might involve taking big risks. I mean, think of all the nature documentaries you've seen mm-hmm. where predation happens at the water's edge, whether it's a crocodile jumping out of the water or a predator sneaking up while an animal is distracted by lapping up water.
Yeah, and some of those predators have traditionally been human beings.
Oh, totally. And of course, drinking water just involves temporarily deprioritizing other important things like, you know, in the natural context, maybe foraging for food or pursuing reproduction, but even think, you know, it might force you to get up from gaming or whatever.
Well, I mean, this is one of those areas, again, where like with humans, so many of us are fortunate that we never have to hunt for water. You know, the drinking water is readily available to us. We have all that we need. And likewise, through human civilization, we tend to have the food situation knocked as well. Again, in ideal circumstances, you're not going to have to spend most of your day foraging for food, which is going to be the case with many different species of animals, where most of the day is about just finding the food, eating the food. And of course, there's no room for anything else. And if you're having to hunt for extra water along the way, then that's getting in the way potentially of this, this vital food hunt.
Yeah. Just as an aside, easy access to clean, drinkable running water is like my go-to example of what's good about modern civilization. You know, there are a lot of people who kind of demonize modern civilization, and there are a lot of things about it not to like, but easy access to clean water is like, that is the most unambiguous good thing I can think of.
Right. I mean, to the extent that it's ridiculous in many cases, you know,
yeah.
Where someone might ask, well, what is this water in your toilet? Well, this is drinking water. The drinking water that comes into the house, it goes into the toilet. We just make sure that the water in there is perfectly fresh and drinkable, which I guess is good for the dogs and the cats. But, certainly that I think you see these various, gray water models that certainly make a lot more sense. Like, why should the drinking water be the water in the toilet? Can't the water from the washing of my hands be the water in the toilet? Wouldn't that make more sense? Of course, it requires more work.
Right. But to come back to the wild context, I mean, obviously there are all these things that would be factors pushing against your acquisition of water when your body needs it. So of course, what an animal needs is intrinsic motivation, actually. They're demotivating factors that are just natural parts of the environment. So acquiring water needs its own intrinsic motivation, hence the motivating desire of thirst. It is a moment-to-moment drive to acquire water that's calibrated by the constantly updated feedback on blood volume and osmolality, though there may also be some other interesting and more surprising inputs on it that we'll get to in a bit. Now, the authors point out that thirst appears to have both positive and negative motivating mechanisms. And I think you can think about food and hunger as an analogy here, because there's something sort of along the same line. So you've got positive reinforcement of fluid drinking behavior by just making drinking water when you're thirsty feel really good. You know, when you're very thirsty, that glass of water, it's delicious. It's wonderful. It feels great. And then you've got the negative reinforcement side, which is that thirst is inherently unpleasant. It is experienced as a type of discomfort or pain that has to be alleviated by drinking fluid. So we all know from experience that these things are true, that you have this positive and negative reinforcement mechanism within the brain for thirst and the drinking of water. But what's very interesting is that, at least at the time of this paper in 2016, how these two mechanisms of thirst are instantiated in the brain is still not fully understood. There are some major question marks remaining, and I think there are at least a few other studies that we can refer to in subsequent parts of the series about where some ideas have developed since then, but there are still a lot of questions out there. And this is one of the reasons that I thought it would be so interesting to pursue thirst as a series on the show, because it's surprising that there are things we still don't know about it. It seems like one of those things that would be absolutely totally understood at this point. But there are some great outlying questions about thirst and how we experience thirst, what are the neural pathways there, how is thirst sated, and so forth. So maybe we'll have to call it for this first part here. I know I'm only halfway through discussing this primer paper, but if we go on through the end of this one, this first episode is going to be 2 hours long or something. So maybe we should call it. What do you think, Rob?
I think so, yeah. I'm actually almost out of water here, and I'm going to have to refill. But yeah, I'm excited to keep going with this. There are a number of little areas I'm hoping we'll get into. The manipulation of thirst by other organisms, and life forms. I want to get back to the taste of water. This is something that's always fascinated me. I mean, granted, water, the taste of water will change depending on where you're getting the water. But you'll sometimes hear people say, "Well, I don't like the taste of water," or will think of water as having no taste at all. I actually found some papers dealing with this topic a little bit, so I think that could be fun to discuss.
People who don't like the taste of water, that is a telltale sign of vampirism.
Just add some red food coloring to it. Then you'll be like, oh, this is great. This is wonderful.
Okay, well, all veins to drink from when we return.
All right. In the meantime, if you want to check out other episodes of Stuff to Blow Your Mind, you'll find them in the Stuff to Blow Your Mind podcast feed wherever you get your podcasts. Core episodes on Tuesdays and Thursdays. Artifact episodes on Wednesdays. Listener mail on Mondays. And on Fridays, we do Weird House Cinema. That's our time to set aside most serious matters and just discuss a weird film.
Huge thanks, as always, to our excellent audio producer, Seth Nicholas Johnson. If you would like to get in touch with us with feedback on this episode or any other, to suggest a topic for the future, or just to say hello, you can email us at contact@stufftoblowyourmind.com.
Stuff to Blow Your Mind is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
There's a lot of pros to drinking Health Aid kombucha. No cons that I can think of. Pro, amazing taste. Pro, pairs well with anything. Pro, probiotic. That's a literal pro. And it's deliciously refreshing. It's the perfect pairing to your meal or great on its own, whether you're having Pink Lady Apple, Berry Lemonade, or one of the other great flavors. It's the perfect swap for soda or alcohol. Make it part of your daily routine. Look for the brown bottle with an anchor on it and try Health Aid Kombucha today.
Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon. Just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
This is Malcolm Gladwell from Revisionist History. eBay Motors is here for the ride. With some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Brake kits, LED headlights, whatever you need, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.